Guys, welcome to Wolf Web 3. My name is Cade. These are my co-hosts. Well, this is my co-host, Charles. He's the COO of Wolf Financial. Today, we are speaking with Thomas, who has spent countless hours tracking the Bitcoin ETF inflows and outflows, even going so far to develop Hey Apollo, which is a tracking suite for every dollar moved in and out of Bitcoin ETFs. He's also the founder of Apollo Sats, which is a Bitcoin products review company who's reviewed over 5,000 products. So buckle up for the next 45 minutes or so while we dive into what Thomas has learned. Thomas, welcome to the show, man. And please tell us about maybe your first orange pill moments and what inspires you to undertake these projects.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. Yeah. I mean, I've been involved in Bitcoin for a number of years, actually. I kind of discovered it maybe 10 years ago or something like that. I was working in traditional finance at the time. Background, actually, I was interning in Australia's central bank at the time when I kind of came across it and thought it was interesting. Studied a bit more at university, did like a research paper on it. I've just been following it for a very long time. And then really a few years ago, decided that myself and a couple of co-founders decided that, you know, we didn't just want to sort of invest in Bitcoin, but actually we wanted to really devote all of our energy and time into it, like our entire lives. Wow. Basically. So we launched Apollo, which has kind of spread out. We're doing a few different things there, just trying to, you know, the sort of vision, I guess, is really to, you know, onboard the masses to Bitcoin. And we think that the best way of doing that is kind of with a focus on the products and services that actually enable that to happen, because these are kind of the tools for onboarding people. We kind of see that maybe there's a couple of hundred million people that own Bitcoin today, but you know, this trend is going, it's going to be everybody probably within a decade, certainly. And so we've been looking at basically, as you mentioned, we have a platform for reviews of products and services in the industry, but we're also looking at, you know, focusing on all of the products that make the biggest difference. And that's why we really focused on these ETFs, because it kind of occurred to us 6 months ago, like a little bit before these ETFs launched, that actually it's kind of this Wall Street adoption, this kind of institutional flows into Bitcoin is really that's actually like the main way we're going to see kind of the next generation of Bitcoiners. We've had these different cycles, if you look at it, over the last sort of, you know, since launch, essentially, where you kind of had the cypherpunks, then you had people that were maybe more sort of interested in kind of Austrian economics. If you went back to, say, looked at maybe this sort of 2012, 13, 14 era, and then probably in the sort of 17-ish era, you started to get more crypto speculation, sort of, it's just an interesting trade. And then sort of 2021, it was also probably more of a crypto cycle overall. But as you guys often talk about, this kind of interesting technology that's out there and towards crypto. But the way I would say people are really going to get onboarded onto it over the next couple of years mainly is through these Wall Street ETFs, because it is fundamentally the store of value proposition, which is most important right now in this sort of time frame of where you've got basically the dollar is going through this kind of massive debasement, and all these people out there that are not necessarily technologically capable enough to hold their own private keys or do any of this kind of sort of the hard work involved to kind of own Bitcoin or crypto necessarily, but they do want the store of value properties that Bitcoin offers. And when you've got companies like BlackRock and Fidelity out there marketing it, it's just going to take off like nothing else. So that's what we're really focusing on. We're focusing on really heavily focused on covering these Bitcoin flows, because that kind of brings in a whole broad new people into Bitcoin that are not, these are like the traditional financial investors. Could be actual, we could well be seeing a kind of coming in from these people that are sort of sovereign wealth funds or endowments and these kind of pension funds. Certainly, kind of financial planners are really interested in Bitcoin for the first time because they've got these clients saying to them, hey, we want to invest. And financial planners up until, 2024 have never really had any way of kind of offering it to their clients, but now they actually can offer it to their clients. And so the question stops being, we sort of stop it in my mind. Bitcoin, you don't have to look at it from the perspective of the like, there's kind of a fresh new perspective on it now, which I would say is this kind of digital property. People can look at it that without kind of any kind of political lens to it, it's just like asset as an asset allocation tool. What are the kind of risk re rewards properties? How much should I allocate it within a portfolio of investments? And people are really looking at it in the context of like, well, I used to be a 60-40 investment type of person, but now maybe I want to have 55% equities, 5% Bitcoin, 40% bonds, or probably should be less bonds. We could talk about that as well. But it's kind of a new era for investors. And that I think is really exciting because it just unlocks a whole bunch of like just so many more people that are not don't maybe share the same kind of old political ideologies, but nonetheless they like the idea of investing in something that's going to go up by 50% year on year on a compound annual basis. So that is just
That
generously,
thing.
it's pretty attractive to a lot of investors.
Wow. Okay, I'm kind of curious. So came in from a TradFi basis into and then got convinced on Bitcoin and pretty much devoted your entire life to it. Do you believe, like, for you, what take on Bitcoin is the convincing part to make you devote your life to it? Because you're taking an institutional approach, but it seems like you're taking it because you believe in adoption more than you believe in store of value for institutions. So for you, is Bitcoin bigger than an institutional store of value, or is that really where you find the weight to it?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of two separate aspects of it. There are the reasons why I love Bitcoin, and there are the reasons why I think the rest of the world will love Bitcoin. It's not necessarily for me. It very much I'm very much attracted to it from its freedom money. I like the ideology behind it. I believe in I believe in the self-sovereignty of Bitcoin, and I think it's fundamentally wrong for governments to be able to steal my wealth without me having a vote to it, basically
Absolutely.
by the inflation tax. Those are my political reasons, like political ideological reasons, which attract me to it, but. That's not necessary. I'm also so like some of a practical person, and I say if people were to be convinced about Bitcoin from a freedom money basis, then I suspect that a lot of the people that are sort of like willing or attracted to that kind of idea probably would have already been like onboarded to Bitcoin in the sense that. You didn't have any kind of greater showing of the importance of that if you went back and looked at 2020, 2021. We had an era of lockdowns and the government printing 40% of the dollars in existence. And if that didn't kind of trigger ideas for you about Bitcoin, if that didn't do it for you, then the freedom money issue isn't going to be what does it for. It doesn't mean you're not going to be attracted to Bitcoin. It just means that that particular narrative, I would say that if it hasn't already attracted to you from something such a significant moment in all of our lives, then let's think about like what else could attract you. And the reality is, and I think this is the kind of a fundamentally important point, which is just that most of the capital in the world is held up in institutions. And so it's like freedom money might be important for you or me, but if I want to unlock the money that's sitting in the Harvard Endowment Fund, that's not what's going to attract them, because that it's just a when you're talking about institutional capital, that's not on their checklist of things that are important to them as an investable asset. Mm. But the properties of Bitcoin in terms of a store of value, inflation hedge, that also is looking to have outsized returns in terms of offering, you know, diversified investment relative to your overall portfolio, and offer like has a, you know, the greatest Sharpe ratio out of all potential assets every year, like has basically been the number one investable asset of like 13 out of the 15 years it's been in existence, something like that.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that is going to attract. It's not like I can talk to somebody else about the politics. I mean, we were talking before we started about, you know, the kind of ideology within like the Bitcoin standard. And I think that's all very interesting, but you don't need to care about freedom money or Austrian economics, or even sort of the separation of money and state. Like, I think personally, I think that's a really important vision, and I love that for me. But I don't necessarily think other people need to subscribe to that in order to be interested in Bitcoin for themselves. And certainly institutions don't need to subscribe to that. You don't need to, like, we don't need to have, I certainly don't think that BlackRock is looking to separate money from state. They're looking at this from they're looking at this from the idea that, hey, if we can get 500,000 coins and pump Bitcoin to $1 million, we're going to be making $5 billion a year in fees in perpetuity. Like, that's enough for them to be attracted to this space. And I think that's actually, from a fundamental perspective, that's the game theory that's made Bitcoin work the whole way since the very beginning. The whole point is that in every aspect of it, whether it is the way miners operate, or whether it is the way, just in every aspect of it, the game theory is incentivized to get people to act in their own best interest to support the network. But fundamentally, they're acting in their, adoption never is going to happen out of the kindness of people's hearts. Like, people, you should never expect people to do anything other than what's in their best interest. It just so happens that we can have people operate in their best interest, and it might have these other kind of downstream effects, like the separation of money and state, which I certainly hope that is an outcome. But we don't need that doesn't need to be on the table for people when it's not something that they want. Like, let's not pitch that to them if they don't want that. So I say
it's a good crossroad.
Yeah.
It's a very good crossroad in between institutional, what they're getting out of the equation, and what like peer-to-peer transfer is getting out of the equation. I look at countries like Venezuela and Turkey who need Bitcoin badly. Like, where are they, if your dollar is inflating drastically day over day, how are you going to store the value in your house before you completely lose the value? If you have cash in your mattress, how are you going to store the value and get out of the country before you literally lose everything that you worked for 20 years? Bitcoin gives you that like out instantaneously to exit into something where you have a store of value. But it seems like the cross stream between both. I was talking to a dev from the Stacks Foundation. He told me this about Bitcoin. It was a really kind of a poetic way to say it. He said, when greed and altruism meet, sometimes you get something beautiful. And he said, the greed part of becoming a Bitcoin miner is that you're rewarded, but the altruism part is that you give peer-to-peer transfer for people that don't necessarily have the ability to trust in their governments to make choices that's on their best interest. And so it's just interesting how you're seeing both cross sections kind of feed both equations. I guess my only, were you going to say something? I don't mean to cut you off.
Look, I mean, I think I really like that way of describing it. I do think it is that kind of, it's the classic invisible hand of capitalism in a way, in which people act in their own best interest, and that serves, it ends up serving the benefit of everybody else. And I think it's just Bitcoin specifically designed such that that was maximized.
Yeah, and the last thing I was going to ask, and I don't mean to derail it, but I was interested in this. So your personal interests on Bitcoin are a little bit different than what you think mass adoption is going to actually have, which is, and this is something I've thought about, and I won't dialogue too much, but a lot of times people in Web 2, they want to be afforded the ability to have ignorance in whatever they're delving into. And that is like when you own a home, nobody needs a gun anymore because you have the police. But back in the day, owning a home was synonymous with having to protect your home. Well, with finances, you know, back in the day, you had to protect your finances. You know, people that had horse and buggy, they'd have a weapon, they'd have the ability to like cover their own home. But nowadays, there's so many like regulatory committees that come in and protect people's assets, protect their home, protect their house, protect their workplace. And so I think, like, you know, as a whole, what's happening is that people going into Bitcoin, just like you said, there's so much friction for them to get adopted into these wallets. And the way to do it is go through a regulatory committee to actually get everybody on board. Do you think the institutional side is a net benefit for the people who are just looking for peer-to-peer transfer and just like being able to use Bitcoin as a whole?
Absolutely. And there's a couple of, look, well, fundamentally, because what you see with Bitcoin is, I'd say its most important property is its store of value property. So the reason why, you know, the reason why, like, there's that old, the old saying is like, the most important trade you ever make is the trades you make with yourself. You're trading your time with yourself, where you focus. And with Bitcoin, when you're adopting it, you're putting in all your energy. Like when you're literally buying into the network, you're putting your energy into the network as a store of value for future use. That's what money is fundamentally. Like, you're saving for the future. And having these kind of institutional flows come in, that is going to be creating a, like, more energy is being added to the network, and it's adding it. Bitcoin is itself deflationary, and it's just enhancing the benefits of that, so that you have more purchasing power in the, you know, you save now and you have more purchasing power in the future. And that's the fundamental value proposition of Bitcoin, that this, you're going to save time, you save your energy now and have more value in the future. And clearly, the more kind of institutional capital that comes into it, the more purchasing power you will have in the future. And so every holder is strengthened as more energy flows into the network. We all benefit from that. And so you can have kind of institutional capital come in, like BlackRock capital come in, and they can buy up like already they've acquired, you know, almost 300,000 Bitcoin. That their holdings don't affect my ability to buy and like, but don't affect my ability to send in a peer-to-peer manner the Bitcoin that I own. But what it does do is it strengthens the value of it. So that is just a fully beneficial aspect to it. And then from the institutional perspective, they benefit too, because they're not necessarily like the peer-to-peer nature of this kind of currency. It's what does it even mean to be a peer, in the sense of like, is it one person, or is it one company, or is it one country? You know, it is peer-to-peer, but when you have a lot of the wealth in this world is not stored by one individual person. It's actually stored in a kind of collective group ownership. And we still need that, like, they still have a problem, right? If you have savings in a collective, like say you're a pension fund, you've got a problem, which is you have these this energy that you're trying to store and grow into the future. But if you're measuring it in dollars, you kind of have a defective unit, a defective measurement, because the value of a dollar is not, it's not constant, actually. It's declining pretty rapidly. And so you still have a problem that needs to be solved by Bitcoin. And that, and Bitcoin can actually solve that problem. And it's might be solving a different problem than it would for an individual, but it still solves a very important problem for these kind of financial institutions looking to, you know, store wealth and grow wealth and for the future. And so we just have a situation in which Bitcoin can offer different things for different people or different peers, depending on like what perspective they're coming from. But it's still, it's all valuable for everybody.
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that. I guess I had, for some reason, like instantly pulled it into the people's coin and the people's network, and it had to be individualized, but it can be a net benefit for all parties involved. It makes no sense that it wouldn't be a net benefit for all parties involved, and it wouldn't make sense for Nakamoto to just exit and be like, never for companies, never for nations, only for people. So it should definitely be that.
And I think this is where you get, see, this is why it's so fundamentally important that Bitcoin is this kind of proof of work network. One of the key, well, there's actually a few reasons why it's fundamentally important, but one of the big things that differentiates Bitcoin from, say, take another kind of competing crypto asset being Ethereum, is that you do have, there are like, If BlackRock were to buy up a whole bunch of Ethereum, BlackRock now would, as via a, because it's a proof of stake network, it would actually be getting increasing control over the network. The more Ethereum you own, the more control you have over the network.
Yeah.
And from your perspective about, do I want a peer-to-peer network with the people's money? Clearly, we don't want to have a situation where a big institutional company comes in and takes control over the network, and now they control the money, right? Like that's exactly what we don't want to happen. That's exactly that's the fiat world we live in today, right? We don't want to have just one giant centralized entity that controls the payment network. You know, that's the kind of the existing fiat paradigm. So yes, it would, if Bitcoin were a proof of stake network, then what I would be saying wouldn't be applicable, because when you have a kind of a, these giant entities come in and buy into the network, it actually can, like in a proof of stake network, it would stop or potentially negatively affect my ability to operate in P2P manner, because if they were to say gain enough control over the network, they could potentially stop me using it in a P2P manner. But the reality is, in a proof of work construct, which is the way Bitcoin operates, it doesn't matter to, like, BlackRock could buy up 5 million coins and it wouldn't affect my ability to use the network whatsoever. It would just enrich, you know, it would just enrich the existing holders, but it doesn't, they have no greater control over the network, because of the decentralized like way that you see that the network actually operates via proof of work. So that's actually a fundamental point. That's why like something like Ethereum really does need to be kind of individual, like in order for it to sort of remain a decentralized network, it really needs to be individual nodes operating. Otherwise it's not, you know, otherwise you still have smart contracts and all of that, but it's not decentralized. If you had like all the big financial institutions sort of buying into Ethereum, you still have something there. You've got smart contracts and all that stuff, but it's not decentralized anymore because they own and operate it. Because that's what it means to have a proof of stake network, where the more you own, the greater control you have. But Bitcoin, it doesn't make, like, we can see Bitcoin in that sense is kind of money for enemies, because I want, you know, I want people that I don't like, I might not, You know, I might share completely opposite political views to them, but they can buy up Bitcoin and it doesn't negatively affect your, you know, there's no, like, if you're, say, looking at something like America and China, America is not, if China were to acquire a whole bunch of Bitcoin, it wouldn't stop America, it wouldn't affect Americans in any kind of negative way. But you wouldn't, you don't necessarily have that dynamic in a something like Ethereum. It's just very different because of the kind of owner operator model with the way the network is actually like the dynamics of the network structure.
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. The when the asset is attached to the ability for the network to hold up, you get errors, which is proof of stake. So it's like the more ownership that you have of the asset, the more problems you can cause to the network as a whole. But you have to be a validator, right? To actually have, but that just means you have to own a certain amount.
In proof of stake, yeah. Once you reach a minimum threshold, I mean, obviously every proof of stake network can be different, but in Ethereum, you have to have 32 ETH to be able to stake your coins.
Yeah.
And I do think, by the way, I think this is a really important point when it comes to looking at, I know that a lot of the big, well, the SEC right now is considering whether to implement these kind of Ethereum ETFs. So a lot of the big players like ARK, BlackRock, they've applied for these kind of Ethereum ETFs. And I think this is going to be one of the issues that the SEC is looking at. So ARK actually just... There is kind of a way to try and address this issue. So ARK actually just said in their kind of latest filing, they actually withdrew the ability to stake on with the Ethereum. So they said, we want to do an Ethereum ETF, but we're not going to stake the coins. And that's one way you can kind of get around this kind of problem dynamic that I described. But the problem with that is that you're creating a situation in which if you were to invest in the ARK ETF, say, imagine that it got approved, for example. If you were to invest in it, then you're foregoing the staking yield because you're buying this Ethereum and there's a yield there, but you're not getting it because you're not staking it. And so the problem with that kind of from a game theory perspective is that if I'm like looking to invest, nobody with serious money is going to invest in an Ethereum ETF that isn't staking, because you could just think about that as effectively a fee on the investment. Like you're missing out on, you're not just paying fees to ARK, you're actually missing out on the 4% yield that Ethereum offers via stake. So really your annual fee is like 5% if you want to invest in an ETF that isn't staking. So that's a problem because no serious investor is going to do that. They're going to find a different mechanism for investing. So that's just the market structure of, say, a proof of stake network. But Bitcoin, luckily, doesn't have any of those kind of fundamental issues. So, which means that when you have this kind of institutional adoption of Bitcoin, it has no, it's purely beneficial. It increases the value of the network, which is great for the existing holders, but it doesn't stop. It doesn't have any kind of negative effect on your or my or any individual's ability to transact within the network on a sort of peer-to-peer basis. It does clearly this is where it's interesting, because clearly owning the Bitcoin, like if you're an investor in the Bitcoin ETF, then you don't have the kind of freedom money aspect that owning Bitcoin outright does. Clearly, it degrades it for the actual ETF owners, because as soon as you buy, if you're investing in Bitcoin via BlackRock, then, you know, you can't send that Bitcoin and appear to be a block. Like you can't actually function within the network. You only have the kind of store of value properties of Bitcoin, but you don't have any of the censorship resistance, like values of it, or the ability to move it to another country, or that you don't have any of those properties. But here's the thing: if you're investing in the ETF, you probably don't care about any of that. Like, if you're the Royal Bank of Canada, which is investing in these ETFs, they're not like, they don't need, or they're not looking for kind of those properties. Like that might be important to you sort of by the ETF, but if you don't, if you're just looking for like, hey, I just want an investment for my portfolio. I want to kind of diversify from like equity beta, but I also want to have, you know, high expected return. Then you can kind of, oh, these ETFs are perfect for me. Like if you're an institutional investor, these ETFs might be great. If you're an individual that's looking for like, you know, if you're an individual in Venezuela that's looking to escape capital controls and you want to, you know, save your like work a job, put it in a currency that can't be like debased, and then take it and move from Venezuela to, I don't know, a different country. Well, look, you actually need the real Bitcoin for that. But if you're Royal Bank of Canada, actually these ETFs are a perfect vehicle for your interests.
Wow.
Yeah, I was going to say that actually is a interesting point because it kind of leads into this question I had. So like we kind of mentioned earlier, you tracked all the ETF inflows and outflows for so long, and you kind of have a very particular angle on the market that maybe the average person doesn't have. So I'm pretty curious on this. You introduced a couple other countries into the conversation just now. I'd love to know from your perspective, because all the information you've kind of been able to download there and the regulatory structure between the US and Australia is pretty different, and you're out there in Australia right now. Can you break down a bit where Australia and US are different because, you know, just in terms of Bitcoin adoption and laws and stuff like that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I would say that Australia isn't all that different in terms of the laws. I would say that Australia is just a much smaller market for, so it doesn't have the same kind of effect on the overall Bitcoin market that there is. But if I can kind of maybe an adjacent question to what you just asked is looking at, for example, there was these Hong Kong ETFs which just launched, and that's interesting because that's kind of China potentially dipping their toes into Bitcoin, and they've long been very anti-Bitcoin, certainly famously banned Bitcoin mining in 2021, which, you know, halved the overall hash rate of the network and all of them. That like prior to their ban in 2021, you had 60% of mining was happening in China, and then it all got dispersed throughout the rest of the world over the last few years because they banned it. They've had this kind of historically anti-Bitcoin stance, but that's kind of easing. And now they've just launched in the last sort of 2 weeks, they've launched these Hong Kong ETFs. And I would say relative to Australia, the reason why I bring that up is because that is a case where that actually really can move the needle in terms of the overall, you know, when we're thinking about basically the price of Bitcoin effectively, what's the level of capital necessary to impact the price of Bitcoin? I mean, Australia, obviously, like Bitcoin is really important to Australians, but Australia is not very important to Bitcoin just because the amount of actual capital there is not going to move the needle. But whereas when you look at, say, these Hong Kong ETFs, they haven't had a massive launch, right? Like they've launched and they've had some kind of institutional flows. But what is interesting for them relative to the overall market is the potential for something what's called a Hong Kong Stock Connect, which is basically allowing mainland Chinese investors to invest in the Hong Kong ETFs, which hasn't happened yet. And that's why there isn't a lot of flows into these Hong Kong ETFs. So right now you can look at the Hong Kong financial markets. It's a relatively small basis, but China itself is enormous. And this is kind of the first step is it has to be approved in Hong Kong. That was a big deal. And then some of these spot ETF providers in Hong Kong have said is that they want to launch it, have it be successful, and then they want to apply for this Hong Kong Stock Connect, which will enable mainland Chinese to invest in these ETFs. And that might not happen for a year or two. Like, it's not going to happen next month. But when it does happen, that's just a massive tailwind behind the coin that it would probably rival even the existing US ETFs, just in terms of the potential capital that could flow into them. So that's not, like, as I said, that's I would say that's like coming in the next 2 years, but it's not here yet. And what's interesting is the cool thing about these kind of ETFs is that they enable this massive investment into Bitcoin, but in a very non, I kind of look at them as a little bit Trojan horse for Bitcoin, in the sense that Bitcoin is able to embed itself further into the existing financial system, kind of monetize itself, essentially, where you're going to create a situation where every person in the world has a kind of a financial stake in the network. But from the government's perspective, they're a lot less scared of it when they're approving these kind of ETFs, because, you know, the money that gets locked in an ETF can't like flow off into another country. Like, they have, like, that kind of security is very, from a capital control perspective, it's a lot less scary for the governments to approve it. So they're actually, they're happy to see the money flow into these ETFs. Certainly they are in America. We'll see whether, like, China approves it for the kind of mainland investors. But I will say that the CEOs of these spot Bitcoin ETFs in Hong Kong are optimistic that approval will happen over the next couple of years. And I mean, they're on the ground there. They're as good a people to ask as anybody else.
Sure. Why do you think China turned down originally and then came back to it? Like, do you, any insights on that?
Yeah, well, look, there's the thing about China is, because it's such a top-down structure, they, like, the person that's was second in command, like, of just behind Xi Jinping, like the one of the biggest, most important figures in China, he actually released a press release banning Bitcoin mining in 2021, and he has since stepped down, left the party. He's retired, essentially. And so,
retired.
Well, I think it actually has retired.
Oh, you think so? Oh, retired. Okay. No, I get it. Well, you remember in Jack Ma.
Yeah, no, I get what you're getting at. But in any case, in a such a centrally controlled situation, it literally can be like one boomer retiring and somebody else has a different view, and like, that's enough.
That is crazy, dude.
Yeah,
that is crazy. A whole nation is like, I retired. Bitcoin's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it is insane, and yet actually, like, in such a top-down, centrally managed, like, having one important person retire and then somebody else comes in and they have a different view, and that can change everything.
Wow. That is not at all what I thought you were going to say. I thought it was going to be like regulatory, like they're looking at their nation, they're trying to figure out why. Just to happen to have a stance from one guy retires, different stance from a new guy. This is crazy.
Look, I will say that I don't want to make it seem like that's 100% of the attribution. I do think that was a big factor.
Sure.
We also know, for example, that, like, there's a game theory element where US have approved it, and now China are going, oh, maybe we should, like, do we want to be so left behind? Like, there's probably some kind of pressures going along with that. So there is always multiple factors going on. I mean, I would say, even, you know, we laugh, but it's not, it is different, but it's also not as different,
that different
as you think. Not as different when you think, when you look at the United States and you think about the key people in power and how a different perspective on it can make all the difference. I mean, even if you look at these Bitcoin ETFs which were approved by the SEC, they had a vote to decide whether they were going to approve the ETFs. They had five people voted on it, and it was 3-2. right? Like in another,
wow.
There's another world in which those ETFs never got approved, and maybe Bitcoin adoption takes another couple of years to, in terms of through this kind of vehicle to play out, right? It was, look, you know, nothing is guaranteed in terms of like, it was likewise, you know, we've got a presidential election coming up, and, you know, we clearly saw in the news where we had a situation in which, you know, Trump came out in the last week and has said, I'm fine with crypto. Well, you just look at the Biden White House and the way they've operated with their management of Treasury Secretary or the Department of Justice. Basically, they've been inherent, like the Biden White House has not been friendly to crypto over the last couple of years, and they have a clear stance on that. Certainly, you know, they have members of the Democratic Party, like Elizabeth Warren, even, you know, like kind of somewhat infamously created her own anti-crypto army, so to speak, a year ago.
Right.
And the point I'm making
so much on the timeline, dude.
Yeah, yeah, of course she does. And the point I'm making is like, it's not necessarily that, like, these things will have a big impact on adoption going forward in the next, like, if you see a Trump White House versus a Biden White House, that will have a big impact on people's perception about the relative, like, basically whether the government gives you like the full green light, like, hey, this is okay and you can do it and you know you're more than welcome to do it, or whether it's going to be like where sort of today is, where we're in an environment where it's like certainly the green light is there via these ETFs, but at the same time you still have a lingering, basically, FUD coming from the White House, and it's not just like, it's not just kind of perceptions. Actually, very important issues. For example, there was a bill passed in Congress last week which would enable banks to custody and lend against Bitcoin. They're not actually allowed to do that today in America.
I saw this. Yes.
So the Congress passed a bill saying that they would allow that to do that. But at the same time, the White House has released a statement saying that, you know, even if the Senate approves it, because it has to go through Congress and the Senate, but even if they do approve it, the Biden administration is not going to sign that bill into law. They're going to veto it. And so the Biden administration is very strongly, you know, that's like that's a very tangible, clear way in which they're directing their efforts to kind of obstruct adoption. And so, and I bring that up to say it's actually not that dissimilar to the China situation, in which
you're right.
A couple of key people in power, you know, you get it, you get some different people in power, and then suddenly you have a very, you know, you get a friendly administration, and then suddenly all things are kicking into gear versus an administration that wants to kind of put the clamps down and sort of slow down adoption. So that's the world we live in.
Charles, it looks like he wants to say something.
No, I don't want to, dude. I'm a curious person naturally. So no, this is just a cool conversation. I think one of the things I was going to ask, what was it? Oh yeah. So if there's so much regulatory mud in the United States, how did the ETF for Bitcoin, like, why do you think that the conversation between Bitcoin and other cryptos is so drastically different when you look at it from an institutional lens? Because it just seems to be like literally black and white, like one is completely different than the other. And maybe the tech might not even be that different for some of these coins and some of these cryptos.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, Bitcoin is a commodity. And pretty much every other crypto asset is a security. And with
why? Can I ask why that is? I heard Saylor say this a couple of days ago, and he didn't explain why. He said everything else is going to get labeled security, but Bitcoin is going to stay a commodity. And I wasn't sure what's the weight on that.
Yeah, so there's something that's called a Howey test, which is how you determine whether an investment is a security or not. Does it? And it's got to do with like, I can't remember off the top of my head all of the rules of a Howey test, but essentially it's things like, Was it issued to investors with the expectation of a profit? These sort of things. And so if you look at the kind of way Bitcoin was created, when Bitcoin launched, it's just very different than every other crypto, because you're going to remember it was created as a network. There's no price on it attached to it for 18 months. So it was just put out there in the open for the public. There was no sale of it. It actually existed for years without there even being a price attached to it. It had a kind of it had such a unique way in which it was launched and created that cannot be replicated by anything else. So now, you know, there is no kind of, there were no like VCs for Bitcoin. There's no founding, there's no, you know, founders or team of, or like it was just an open source project that anybody can contribute to. There's no price attached to it. There was no pre-sale. Nothing else kind of has those characteristics or qualities. Everything else is kind of, you know, much more close to a business launching, you know, basically a business startup, essentially. Like everything else is kind of a startup company that is kind of on crypto rails. And that's why they all tend to be listed as securities. Now, where the one sort of really gray one, though, you kind of have these obvious securities that like nobody even questions whether they're securities. That's like most of them. And then there are some other kind of gray ones. For example, Ethereum. Most of the sort of experts that look at it would say Ethereum was definitely a security when it was launched. You know, it basically ticks all the boxes. Like it had a pre-sale, it had, you know, had a founding team, all this kind of stuff. But that was actually 8 years ago. And there is an argument to be made that Ethereum has decentralized over time, such that even though it was a security on the day it was launched, it's not actually a security today. And that's why you may have seen, you know, Gary Gensler be asking a number of times, in fact, like talking to Congress, all these things, is Ethereum a security? And very like, they never really want to give you a straight answer on that, because it's very, well, the reason why is because it's fundamentally like, what's going to happen, I think, eventually is it's going to be decided in a court, essentially. They're going to have, like, it's just so gray for Ethereum, because it clearly was a security, but, you know, it might actually not be a security today.
And the amount of things that leads to, if they rule in favor of it not being one, then the doors are open. Then everyone comes in and says, well, what about me?
Yeah. And certainly, there are other kind of big, and it's not to say that, yeah, Bitcoin is the only one that's definitely a commodity, because, for example, all the forks of Bitcoin are clearly not securities either. I mean, think about Bitcoin Cash. That is, that was Bitcoin for the first, you know, up until sort of 2017, or it was this Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash were the same thing. It was a hard fork away from Bitcoin, changing the block size of one of the kind of characteristics of Bitcoin, and became a separate chain. Nonetheless, it had the same, I mean, Bitcoin Cash was started, had the same basis as Bitcoin. It was exactly the same up until that hard fork. And so clearly Bitcoin Cash is not a security either. So it's not to say that I think you could go through a list and go, yeah, there's actually a whole bunch of them that are not securities. But when you're looking at, like, basically, if there was a VC and a pre-sale and a pre-mine and all these things, that those are the kind of characteristics of what creates a security.
I see. And Gary can't make a clear distinction in front of people, because once he does, it's just craziness on both sides. Like, it's not good on either side for him.
No, well, I think that my perception is that he wants he feels that Ethereum is a security, but doesn't have maybe the doesn't have he's not necessarily confident enough that they can win in, like, he doesn't want to concede it's not a security, but he doesn't feel confident enough he can win a court case to prove that it is a security either. And so I kind of stuck in the mud. I mean, you got to imagine, right? Like, we got to remember that even a case against Ripple, which, like, XRP, which is should be a much easier case to win than Ethereum. Like, you know, if they were barely able to win their case against Ripple, as which is like we can tell you who the, you know, Ripple CEO is, and it's like that's a much clearer case, and they were barely able to win that case, and the way the judge ruled was like, oh yeah, in some aspects yes, but in other aspects no, and they basically barely struggled to win that case. So if they can't even declare, you know, XRP is security, essentially, like, it's a much harder task going after Ethereum. And so I just don't think he thinks he has the, they don't have like the case properly to make. He doesn't want to concede it either. So he's kind of just like, you know, half either way. But also gets back to,
watch this.
Yeah, it gets back to what we were saying earlier. I mean, we might see a Trump White House administration come in, appoint a different person and see SEC, and then they'll just say like, oh, Ethereum? No, that's not a security. Don't worry about it. And then, you know, it's all.
That would be crazy. Do you imagine just come in and just like, nope, make a decision and move on. Like, it's like, it doesn't even matter. We're just sitting here like, oh, we were fighting this for like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What would really change?
Yeah, what would happen? What would the first few dominoes be after this? Something like that would go.
Say Trump comes in and he's just like, nah, no. Like, what happens to the landscape in crypto?
Well, I mean, if you created, well, look, I mean, the biggest, I mean, I think there's no question that people are, prison risk is the number one concern people have in trying to work in crypto. Literally, like
yeah.
you know, that's so. I do think that if they decided, you know, like all it's Wild Wild West, do whatever you want with crypto. Which I'm not saying they will do that, but I'm just kind of like laying out that if they were to say, yeah, you know, hey, crypto is totally different. Do whatever the hell you want. Well, yeah, I mean, there'll be a flood of VC money coming into it, and it would, you know, that you would have a boom cycle again, and there would be a lot of, by the way, there'd be a lot of like negative consequences of that because people would be scammed and all this kind of stuff too. So like, I'm not necessarily advocating one way or the other. I'm just kind of describing.
Really? Wow.
How it will play out, but no,
I think that's so true because you see people getting scammed all day, and the conversation is you shouldn't be so ignorant. It's not like call the police, but you see scams in Web 2 or like Ponzi schemes, and people are like, you should be calling the police. You should put a tip in. Who are you going to tip in Web 3, man? There's just nobody to go to.
Zach XBT, like, you lost your bro. Zach XBT.
Zach. He's out here. He's the people's man.
You know, adds to the 1,000 people.
Yeah. So, but I do think that putting aside that's kind of crypto stuff. I mean, I do think that if you just had an administration that said, hey, we'd be happy for banks to custody and lend against Bitcoin, that would open up a wave of liquidity for people to be attracted to the investment asset, because then it becomes like that is the ultimate sort of tax resilient asset, in the sense of you can invest in Bitcoin, never sell it, have capital gains, and you just borrow money, you know, when you want fiat money, you can just borrow money against it. And that's like, that's what
it's productive.
That would be fantastic for a whole class of wealthy individuals looking to kind of create a really like invest in a really tax efficient vehicle. But you know, so that's something that could be unlocked with a friendly administration, and banks would love it because they can just make money That's their business model, is like, you know, and you've got this kind of, in some ways, it's a really, well, Bitcoin has its issues with being a sort of an asset that's used to back loans because it's volatile. But on the other hand, the banks can custody it themselves. So that takes away all of the risk from there. Like there's absolutely zero kind of credit risk from there. You know, if you have over collateralized loans against Bitcoin,
because they can just liquidate right away.
They can just liquidate,
cover their loans instead of like having a house to sell.
Yeah, because exactly, which is illiquid and harder to sell, and it takes a lot of time. Like with this, there's no credit risk. There's no liquidity risk. Like it's in some ways it's the perfect asset, as long as there's the demand for it. And I'm sure they would love it, but it has to be approved for that to happen.
Wow. When did you first get into Bitcoin? At what price was BTC on your first purchase?
It wasn't... Oh, look, I prefer not to answer that question, actually, but...
No, don't. There's zero pressure. No, yeah, don't feel pressured to answer at all.
But I would say that, like, for me, it definitely took a long time. You know, there's a big difference... Big difference between when I like first kind of dabbled in it versus how long. Like, I was one of many people. I think it takes like years to. I wasn't one of those people that like got it straight away and started investing heavily. Like,
absolutely, you're like, speaking to that guy. I own zero Bitcoin. I own zero Bitcoin.
Zero.
Nothing. No BTC at all.
You've been reading all this Bitcoin stuff. You still haven't bought any?
Nonstop. I love it. I think it's amazing. But I hold all different cryptos. Mm. I don't hold any Bitcoin. I hold Solana mostly. I hold some really, really good, what's it called? Pith. And then Jupiter, which I think is the best DEX on Solana there is. So I'm holding more so, and it's like literally 1%. Like, I'm still very traditional. I save cash. So I'm very old school in that, but I love Bitcoin. I really do. And that's why when we first got on the call, like, I'm a big guy into the tech. I love, like, I was just researching. I had a ChatGPT built out to help me understand runes and ordinals. And I put in the whole ordinals document and starting to understand like op return, how we're stuffing these UTXOs, and like basically putting like arbitrary data inside of these UTXOs to create like coins on top of it. Very interesting to me because I love the tech side of it. So it's a little less for me a love affair of freedom and currency and commerce and trade, mostly because, and I'm a firm believer, that people always dive into their deficits. So if you see somebody that loves Bitcoin, typically from a freedom of commerce perspective, it's people who have really understood inflation, like Venezuela and Turkey. Like, they know. It's the same with people who like really value their items. Typically they come from a poor past. So no, I'm a firm believer. I've never experienced any of those things in the US. I've never went without anything in my life. So freedom of currency, like, it's a good value system, but I don't truly understand the depths of the need for it. But tech for me has always been cool. I got into crypto because I was building out ETH miners back in proof of work. And then I started doing it myself. I fell in love with it, started building them out for clients. And I was like, dude, this is like the coolest thing. I'm making money every single month. And the 2021 bull run, dude, before EIP 1559, I was like, yes. This is a great time to be alive. So yeah, but anyway, I don't mean to derail too much. Sorry, guys.
No. I think it's really fascinating. I think that, and it also does talk to how there's so many different kind of angles with why people can be interested in this kind of stuff. I also like come from it. Been working in tech as well for a number of years. So like finance, but fintech, and I find the tech stuff to be absolutely fascinating as well. So I do think it's really interesting that, you know, some people come from a purely economic, protect yourself from it. It's like there's kind of an economic narrative behind it. There's a tech narrative behind it. There's a freedom narrative behind it. Like there's a whole bunch of different ways in which people can kind of be attracted to it. It could be very different, like, very different reasons. Like there's a kind of a huge space of which people can find themselves interested in it for completely, like, yeah, just orthogonal reasons.
Yeah, mine's definitely sandwiched there in between with you guys. The tech is fascinating. The more I learn about it, it gets more fascinating. Mm. But I definitely got it because I bought a bunch of Dogecoin in 2019. That was the main reason I got it.
Would you get
lost all of it? And then I was like, okay, now I need to know what just happened because that was insane. And I'm addicted. And then the tech got me, the people got me, the conversations got me. There's so many conversations happening. And then I was like, wait a second, there's like hundreds of thousands of people who are into this stuff. And then, you know, fast forward like 4 years, 5 years, whatever. And now here we are, like on a podcast, literally talking about Bitcoin after ETFs have been passed and all this crazy, crazy stuff. It's been the wildest time.
Mm. Wow. No, that's really cool.
Yeah, really I think cool. It is interesting. Meme coins seem to be an entrance way more than I ever would have thought of. And they're so like, I was just talking to somebody the other day and he was like, he's like a volatile guy and he was raging on the idea of meme coins. He was so angry. And it was default. Oh. And so he's going like parabolic about how much he hates meme coins. And he was like, why would we put all this like this capital and liquidity and TVL that could be built on good platforms into something that has zero value? He said, in addition to that, he goes, every single time a normie gets ripped off on a meme coin, he says, what you are is you're making a big sign that says regulate me in the most like robust and parabolic way because people are getting ripped off. And he said a lot of times it just burns people and like begs for regulation across the board. But I feel like I brought that up to somebody else and he told me, he goes, bro, I get burned on regular projects. He's like normal projects. He's like, at least with a dog, I knew what I was getting into. He's like, the other projects just left after 6 months. So I don't know. I feel like that conversation goes both ways when it comes to adoption for users, which is so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my perspective on that is I kind of think of like from a historical basis, when you look at what's really common in a high inflationary periods is people look to gambling. It's if you look at what happened, there are kind of really interesting books. Like there's a book about a high inflation period in France in the 18th century called Fiat Money, Inflation in France. Or you have the Germany, there's a book, the Weimar Republic in the 1920s, and there's a book about that period called When Money Dies. And in both cases, what you see is you see a massive increase in gambling within the public. People
is
really,
that true?
Yes. But so when the currency starts to kind of lose value at a rapid rate, you see people start throwing it at random. So gambling becomes like, it just goes parabolic within society.
And what does that say about us? Like, well, our money's losing value. Let's start just gambling.
I think that's essentially what's happening here. Not to say that we're going through a kind of a hyperinflation period like those periods, because clearly we're not. The currencies are losing value, like these sort of fiat currencies, but not in a kind of a hyper way. But nonetheless, if you look at like, if you just take a 10 year view on it, and you look at like how much does a house cost today versus how much the house cost a decade ago, and you're okay, housing is up like 200%. And that to me is kind of the rough, like it's the same house, right? This is like, that's the inflation rate. That's kind of what I look at. I mean, if you look at, just take gold over the last 20 years, and gold is just a dumb rock. Gold is like literally a useless rock. And it's
sure.
And the dollar has lost 88% of its value relative to gold over the last 20 years. So, you know, gold is sort of 7x'd. Now that kind of tells you about how much actual inflation is happening. And that's why also certainly like the houses, the housing in, you know, where I live, certainly in Australia, like everything is up, you know, basically 10x over the last 25 years. Like that's kind of the level of inflation we've had. I do think one of the big mistakes people make is they think the consumer price index is inflation. So they go, oh, okay, inflation is 2.5%. It's like, nah. Like a basket of goods measured by, you know, a government defined basket of goods is up 2.5%, but What about a housing? Oh, it's not like we don't measure that. But what about the stock market? Oh, we don't measure that. But why? Like, I want to like one of the most important things anybody wants to do is like get rich. Do you want to be poor? Nobody wants to be poor. They want to get rich. Oh, well, you know, you can't do that because it's just 10x. Everything is 10x. All assets are 10x price over the last decade. That's massive inflation that we've experienced over 20 years. Certainly most of it's gone into financial assets. But and then the real world asset that's kind of halfway in between is housing. But nonetheless, that is a consequence of a just enormous increase in the money supply. And we've had this massive inflation. And, you know, we live in the year 2024 and we're so rich that everything is so abundant that it doesn't seem to matter how much money is printed. We still have the skills to be able to, you know, make a ham sandwich. So those kind of skills, we're going to still be able to do that fairly cheaply, even in a hyperinflation event. But some of the other things that are kind of scarce, we can't do. So we can't create more houses. So they just rocket up in price. You know, when you look at this has always happened, by the way. We had a situation where if you look at, say, Weimar Republic, the price of potatoes went from like 5 marks to 8 marks in a period in which the price of a sausage went from like 30 marks to 30 million marks. And so they had this hyperinflation event, but you could actually always just get potatoes because potatoes were not hard to make. Like, so it didn't matter how much money printing they had. Society was at a point 100 years ago where they can print to infinity. We're still going to have potatoes for everybody. Like, that's something that they were capable of doing. Likewise, 2024, we're so rich and so abundant, they can print to infinity and basic consumer items like Netflix, we could still provide that for you pretty cheaply, although they have had inflation actually. But generally speaking, like, you know, like these kind of random consumer goods that you and I like to buy it's not going up by too much. It doesn't matter how much they print. But the scarce things really are going up a lot. Like Bitcoin obviously is up, you know, 20x over 5 years. So and that's kind of the way I see this going. I think in my kind of mental model of the world is we have a lot of inflation, far more than it appears when you look at kind of the consumer price index. Consumer price index goes, all right, you know, inflation's 4%. I can cop 4%. But if your model is actually like if the real inflation rate is somewhere like, you know, fluctuates a lot, but let's say the real inflation rate is like 15%. You have a very different perspective on the world, and then it kind of changes the way, like, and I think that if people kind of operate as though that were the case without even necessarily knowing it, and that's why you kind of have these kind of change of behaviors, and so everybody is just massively gambling at meme coins and this kind of thing, because it's like everything is going crazy in a world where the currency is being debased at a pretty rapid rate. That's my mental model of what's happening.
Whoa. Wow. No, it's a giga brain moment. Yeah. Those books on inflation, were those eye-opening for you when you started getting into like what happens in the past? I feel like a lot, like where I thought, like, I was reading Bitcoin Standard, and I thought quantitative easing was kind of a new principle. But like, I don't know how closely this is aligned with like, but in the book it talks about, and I'm pretty green on all this, but it talks about like back in the day, they used to clip gold coins. And so like stretching a currency, there's only two ways for a government to create more of something or buy more or basically have like a budget surplus is either by taxing the people more or by printing more money inherently. And so have you garnered, do you feel like people that really want to understand? Because I feel like for me, economics is muddy. Like when I look through the lens of being able to understand other concepts and principles, like this one feels sort of like not exactly clear, because like ultimately some prices of some items are going up, but some prices of some items are staying down. But inherently when you print more money, like, I don't know, I guess I just feel like after you start to get into this, money is a representation of energy. Like it's a representation of effort. And that was the whole point of it, is that you could put effort and then have this effort like on like an exchange of medium and then give it to another person. So I guess for me, do you feel like looking into the past to kind of get an understanding of what's happening in the economic models now is giving you a lot of clarity?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, quantitative easing is not that they kind of created a new name in 2010. Like I think that name was new, quantitative easing, but that's not a new, like what they did was like, what the hell even is that? That's printing money to, that's what that is. Because what happens is that you have government issue, government borrows bonds. So government borrows money by selling bonds. Oh, okay. And who are they borrowing money from? The Federal Reserve. Oh, okay. Where'd the Federal Reserve get the money from? They printed it. So that's what that is. And that, there is a ton of precedent for it. In fact, there's nothing but precedent for it. If you look at the history of fiat monies in human history, like it's been done thousands of times before. Like there's nothing new here, but it's never like, if anything, what's interesting is how long it's lasted. Because we're in a situation in which, you know, the fiat money essentially was created for, like, basically started in 1971. And we've got this kind of, we're sort of 53 years into this experiment where, you know, the dollar is not backed by anything. It's just created out of nothing. And typically, it typically doesn't last that long. But, you know, if you just look at the value of a dollar relative to a house, I think that's probably the clearest way of seeing the actual kind of fall in valuation of it, because the house is just a house and people want it to live in homes. You know, there's no extra demand for homes. There's nothing about our generation that wants to live in a home more than a past generation. Everybody always wanted a roof over their head. And so the fact that a house costs 10 times as much today as what it did 30 years ago kind of just shows you the dollar's lost 90% of its value. But that's like normal, to be expected. And that's going to, like, that's just going to keep continuing well into the future. There's every reason that the system was designed such that this would happen. And so that's why it's the same reason why, like, it's just going to keep, even if you didn't have any more people investing in Bitcoin, it would just keep going up forever, because the dollar is going down forever. It's just you just have a deflationary system versus an inflationary system where one currency is fixed and the other one is growing by 20% a year. And it's kind of that simple, really.
Listen, I feel like we could go for another 2 hours on this Bitcoin conversation find new.
This is a lot bigger than I thought.
We're gonna have to do this again. What do you think, Charles? What do you think, Thomas?
100%, dude. Thomas,
yeah, absolutely. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah, seriously, thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, I was going to say I have more questions, but we'll just keep going. So how about this? How about we finish off? Maybe is there anyone you want to shout out? Any team members, friends, family that you want to shout out before we end this show?
Yeah, well, look, I would just say that we have a daily email covering all of the kind of most important flows in Bitcoin, really, like charts, news, analysis. Like, I think it's an awesome email, and I would recommend everybody subscribe to it. It's called Flow State, and you can find it in my Twitter profile, which is, I'm at Thomas Farah. So you can find it there.
Awesome. Awesome. Perfect. Charles, do you have anything you wanted to end us on?
No. Just thank you so much for your time. You know what I mean? You can't get it back, so I appreciate it. You spent it here.
That was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, man, seriously, thank you so much. You could have been anywhere on this Monday, but you're with us. Really appreciate it. Guys, thank you so much for watching this podcast. This is Wolf Web3 out. My name is Cade. We have Charles, our COO. We have Thomas here, the Bitcoin expert. It was a great time. We'll see y'all later.